Listen, I chose you, Walter, because you're a man of integrity. I could have gone to the New York Times. I could have gone to the Washington Post, but I chose you.
Can I make a suggestion?
Sure.
Can I make a suggestion here? You want to save the world? Great. Write a letter. Make it as juicy as you want and send it to my attention, okay? I'll see if I can't get you a column in the letters to the editor section on Saturday, okay? Remember, the pen is mightier than the sword,
Walter,
okay?
okay, Walter, I've got a deadline too. And in about 2 hours, people are going to die.
Let's get together. I'll say it first. We all love fun. And it's time for Kill Me Cast. Yeah, it's time for Kill Me Cast.
Welcome to Kilmer Cast. Here is your host, Francis Rizzo III.
Thanks, Bernard. Welcome to all the Val Pals out there listening to a new episode of Kilmer Cast. I'm your host, Francis Rizzo III, and I'm here to talk about the films of Val Kilmer, one of the most truly fascinating American film actors of the modern era. On this episode, we'll be checking out Kilmer's role as a possibly homicidal professor in 2009's The Chaos Experiment. Joining us to chat about the film and Kilmer's role in it is a writer and horror buff whose work can be found in many places, including Ghouls Magazine and her own Little Red Horror blog. It's Scotland's own Kim Morrison. How are you doing today, Kim?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. How is life going in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, it's all right. We're coping with the current situation in the world just now. We seem to be getting out of stuff. So it feels almost back to normal. So it's pretty chill compared to last year.
Yeah, it feels like in America, people are acting as if the pandemic is just basically over, even though I know there's a lot of variants going on and masks are increasingly rare. Are people wearing masks still in Scotland?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we ever really wore them outside. That was never really anything anyone suggested to us. But inside, yeah, we're still pretty good at it. But it is getting a little bit like, people are sort of leaning into the it being a bit over kind of thing, which is a little bit scary. But yeah,
it is a little bit scary. I recently I forced myself to actually make a return to the movie theaters for the first time. And I had an accidentally private screening of Edgar Wright's The Sparks Brothers. I was the only person in the theater. which I appreciated for sure because it felt very safe and I enjoyed the film. It's fantastic. What's the status of film going for you?
Yeah, for Scotland, our cinemas opened a few weeks ago, I think. We went to see A Quiet Place and The Conjuring 3. They sort of came out all at once. And I'm sure I've been to see something else. I can't remember. And Freaky just came out this week as well. So we're hopefully going to go and see that. So yeah, everything's just kind of opened up on that front for us. So it's sort of been a rush to the cinema to see everything that we've missed in the last year.
Yeah, after seeing The Sparks Brothers, I kind of got like that itch to go back again and again. But then we don't have a lot of great films out right now in America. It's basically Fast and Furious 9 and like some other stuff that I have no interest in seeing because it's already been out on, we have a lot of it out on streaming. And so, and I took advantage of that when it was at home because, I mean, I really enjoy watching films at home. It's definitely something that's nice to be able to just start it whenever you want and, you don't have to have any interruptions or anything like that.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think we missed a lot of the stuff on streaming. They just held it away from us until it could be released in the cinema. So but it's been quite nice now because it means there's stuff to go and see. So yeah.
That's fantastic. So since this is Kilmer Cast, we should talk a bit about your own experience with Val Kilmer. What would you consider your favorite Val Kilmer film? If you have a favorite Val Kilmer film, it's possible you don't have one.
I think I'm trying to think. I maybe don't as an adult, but as a kid, I watched Willow a lot, and I watched like the old kind of four Batman films quite a lot. So it's probably one of those two. But I sort of realized that I haven't actually seen a lot of stuff like of his newer things. I was actually we weirdly watched the Jay and Silent Bob reboot before. We sat down to watch the Chaos Experiment, and I was like, oh, we're watching two Val Kilmer films in a row. But that's weird because I don't think I've watched one in like 10 years. Probably Willow, but I have not seen that since I was about like 12 or something now. But that's probably the one that I watched the most in his whole filmography.
Well, if you had to pick any film that would be your favorite Val Kilmer film, that's a solid choice because it's a really fun film and it's one of his better performances. Especially, it's a unique performance for him because it's not doing comedy, it's not doing drama, it's that action fantasy, which between that and like you said, Batman Forever, it's definitely a unique part of his background.
I also remembered that I recently watched Mindhunters, which I'd never seen. It was on the horror channel over here, and I freaking loved that. That was amazing.
That is a definitely a different kind of film. Unfortunately, he's not in it very long.
No, I know. It had so many like Christian Slater and things in it. I was like, I've literally never heard of this film, but the synopsis sounds good. And then when I watched it, I was like, this is amazing. I love this. So yeah, I've watched that more recently. That's probably pretty high up there as well, just because it was so much fun. But yeah, you're right. He's not in it. He's not in it very much.
Yeah, that was a little disappointing when I watched it. And I was like, oh, it's not. He's like in it for like maybe 10 minutes at most. But, you know, he makes an impact. That's for sure. He's always, when he's on screen, you want to watch him. And that goes for today's film today. But before we dive into it, we should go back in time.
Gather round as we put Kilmer in context.
So the Chaos Experiment had a very limited release on May 1st, 2009 in America. We will get into how limited in a little bit, but let's talk about what's happened around that time. At that time, Sweden legalized gay marriage, which is a big step there. The world was at the start of the H1N1 flu pandemic, which would eventually kill an estimated 290,000 people. You hear a number like that, it's almost quaint now based on what happened with coronavirus. It's insane.
I know,
that.
Right?
Yeah, and like, you know, I don't know what the situation was in Scotland at the time for the H1N1 flu, but in America, we barely even noticed it.
I was gonna say I don't remember it. I might have just blocked out if it was kind of traumatic at the time, but I don't remember it being a significant thing. Not like it is just now, anyway.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible when you consider 290,000 people. That's only about half of what has been killed. Well, at least in America. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the scary thing is that there's so many other people have been killed across the world. But I mean, a 290,000 deaths from a flu, and we're just like, oh yeah, that happened, I guess. It's kind of perspective that we get in the end. The video game Minecraft was first released to the public, which is crazy to me because it feels like it's been around forever. Do you ever play Minecraft?
I haven't. I have watched people play it quite extensively, like in my house and things, but I've never actually played it. It's kind of the thing. I feel like it's kind of the thing I would like. I enjoy games like The Sims and like Animal Crossing and stuff. I get the idea of like building a house and looking after little square pigs and stuff would actually be quite fun, but I've never dealt in it.
Yeah, there's definitely I see the appeal of the game. I've been drawn into play a couple of times by my daughter, who is addicted to Minecraft. She just loves to build and build, and I mean, I'm like, we have Legos, you could play with Legos and do the same thing, but Minecraft apparently has a little more appeal for her because you get to fight, you know, zombies and dragons and all this other stuff, which I guess is a little better.
Yeah, definitely.
At this time also, actress Maggie Gyllenhaal wed Peter Sarsgaard, which I believe set a record for the most double letters in wedding history combined the two. And Dom DeLuise died at the age of 75. Dom DeLuise was so great in History of the World Part 1 and so many other films. I don't think he gets, you know, as much credit today. I don't know if you're Dom DeLuise, you know, much knowledgeable of his career.
No, I don't. I, you know, it's probably one of those people that I do know them to look at, and I'm just not connecting the name.
Yeah, I want a very American performer. I wonder if he had any breakout across international borders. Definitely, I can see his appeal mainly in the U.S. And he had some really solid films. A film called Fatso that he did when he was younger that was really impactful. And he also did the Cannonball Run films with Burt Reynolds, which were a lot of fun. He was wild in those films. So kind of a he set the stage for later actors like John Candy and Chris Farley, definitely in that mold. So let's take a look at the top of the Billboard charts at the time. So the Kilmer Cast house band is back with another hit. It's kind of somewhat nonsensical ode to bass. That's basically the whole point of the song. You know, this is the song Boom Boom Pow by Black Eyed Peas that gave us the iconic line, I'm so 3008, you're so 2000 and late. What's your experience with this song?
So in 2009, I was working in a record shop in Scotland called HMV, which was a big chain, but there's not many of them left now. And this album, this Black Eyed Peas album, which I can't actually remember what it's called, but it used to be on all the time, just on repeat, because it was super popular. So I think I have the lyrics of 90% of the songs that I just drummed into my head. So no, I do like the Black Eyed Peas. I'm more of like a pop punk person, but I do like pop music as well. So yeah, that is definitely ingrained in there. In fact, probably most stuff from 2009 is just at the time, and it just getting blasted with it.
Yeah, the music video for this song, it's very strange. A lot of close-ups of the Black Eyed Peas and some weird, like Twin Peaks-esque dancers in the video. Yeah. And it has this weird out-of-place anti-war message laid over it that's completely separate from the song. There's nothing in the song that would indicate that, but it's all over the video. And there's also this really ridiculously obvious product placement for HP computers, because he uses a HP touchscreen to manipulate the stuff in the video. I'm telling you, when the Black Eyed Peas sell out, they sell out hard. They go for it.
Like political message and product placement at the same time.
Yeah, why not? Let's have it all. Yeah, exactly. At number two, we had Lady Gaga with Poker Face. So this was her second single off of her debut album. Obviously a tribute to everybody's favorite five-card casino game. There's no sub messages here at all, right? unbelievably catchy this song is. It just really just grabs you. But it also had the added benefit of some controversy over the lyrics. I don't know if you remember this, but it's pretty clear. She changes out poker face for F her face. I mean...
Yeah, I've actually seen this quite recently going around like Instagram, people like recording films of themselves reacting to that. And it's one of those things where I'm like, I'm not, he's trying it. Like, I think it's been in your head for so long that it's just poker face. I'm like, I can't really, I really need to watch her singing it and get the lip read.
Yeah, I mean, some people claimed it was just her accent being from Queens, New York, that it, you know, it has like an inflection on it, but it's pretty clear that if you listen to the pronunciation, it is not the same word when she says it.
It definitely sounds different. Yeah, it does.
At number three, we had Flo Rida with Right Round. What's your thoughts on this song?
I feel like I have this, the memory of this from being in the Pitch Perfect film rather than the actual
the original song. Yeah, I feel like a lot of the songs in Pitch Perfect, I have that same feeling about, where I didn't hear it originally, but I definitely heard it in Pitch Perfect.
Yeah, I definitely heard it at the time, but it's the, whenever I hear it, my head flicks to the Pitch Perfect.
You know, obviously this is, it has that chorus by Kesha, but it's based on the classic, I don't know if you remember, Dead or Alive, the song You Spin Me Round, which, I mean, this song, I guess it's either about oral sex or strippers on a pole. Not sure which one, because they're both in there, I believe. But either way, I'd much rather listen to the original. Did you ever see, because as I was doing my research for this one, that Jimmy Fallon and Paul Rudd did a shot-for-shot remake of that You Spin Me Round video? Did you ever see that?
I have a feeling I did, because I watch most of the stuff that Paul Rudd ever does with Jimmy Fallon's show. So I feel like I probably have, but
it was amazing.
I'll definitely go and watch it now to make sure.
I mean, and he actually sings the song. He doesn't lip sync to it, which is is fantastic. I'm like, Paul Rudd, you're amazing. Every time I hear something about Paul Rudd, I'm always afraid. Like, if I see him trending on Twitter, I'm like, oh, Paul Rudd, what'd you do? You finally disappointed me after being so amazing for so long. But hopefully he just holds on and doesn't become a creepy person.
No, I have faith in Paul Rudd that he's going to be fine.
So I thought it'd be interesting, since you are from Scotland, if anybody couldn't tell from your accent, that we take a look at the top of the Scottish charts as well from the time, because, obviously there's a lot of difference between what we listen to in America and what people listen to in Europe. And that's actually part of what, when I saw the Sparks Brothers film, because I don't know if you know Sparks, the band.
No.
So, I mean, they've been around for 50 years, unbelievably influential, 25 albums they've made. And yet, like, nobody really knows. Most people don't know Sparks. You might have heard a song here or there, but the odd thing is they are an American band, which I had no idea. I thought they were European because of their aesthetic and the kind of music they sing. But if they were huge in Europe and just not in America, even though they were an American band, they had to go to Europe to find success. So there's definitely a lot of differences between what we listen to here in America and what you listen to in Europe, especially in Scotland. And so at number one, the number one song was Something Squeezing My Soul by Morrissey. Do you remember that song?
No, I don't. I obviously know Morrissey, but I can't place that song.
Yeah, that was the number one song in Scotland at the time. And obviously Morrissey, I mean, the only time Morrissey's ever charted in America, I believe, was the More You Ignore Me. Which was pretty huge here. I doubt Morrissey will be charting anytime soon.
Yeah, no, that's impressive. I didn't think he was still relevant enough in 2018 to be number one.
Number two was Untouchable by Girls Aloud.
Oh, nice.
Now, what is Girls Aloud? Because that's something that never broke through in America.
So Girls Aloud one of the versions of like Pop Idol, X Factor type things. It was like they had a version where they made a boy band and a girl band, and they fought against each other, and the girl band won, and it was Girls Aloud, and they were really, really popular. Cheryl Cole was in them, who went on to have like a solo career and things, so she was quite popular, and she still does things now. But yeah, they were huge for like a few years before they split up. They were just like the quintessential kind of girl band and things. So they were a very successful story to come out of a reality TV show.
Would you compare them more to like the Spice Girls or to like the Pussycat Dolls perhaps?
I think maybe somewhere in the middle. They always had very like over the top choreographed dance routines, but not as like slick as the Pussycat Dolls. But they were very good and they could all actually sing and things.
That's nice.
Yeah, so no, they were really good. They weren't as good as like Little Mix and stuff that came like kind of later. But yeah, somewhere in the middle of those two, I would say.
And at number three was Know Your Enemy by Green Day, which, you know, it definitely had some play in America. What's your experience with Green Day? Because that's like, you know, it's interesting to see a band that's very American breakthrough like that to number three in England. Scotland, sorry, my bad.
Yeah, I mean, I got into Green Day in like high school. I think it was like when the Warning album came out was when I first kind of became aware of them, because that was when we got in our house. We got like satellite television, so I had all the music channels and I could actually learn songs that weren't on the radio. So it was quite exciting. So yeah, like American Idiot and stuff was huge over here. So I think when like Know Your Enemy came out and stuff, it was kind of the wave of that. I don't think Green Day really chart for stuff like kind of after that, but yeah, American Idiot was absolutely massive, so I think it was just kind of the wave of that afterwards.
Cool. I looked at the what was top three in America and see where they stood in Scotland. Poker Face was number 8. That was the highest ranking of the three. Right Round actually was 13th, so right there. And oddly, Boom Boom Pow was not in the top 100 in Scotland in singles. So I wonder if perhaps it maybe just came in a little later. You know, sometimes release dates are different from country to country. So maybe Boom Boom Pow hadn't made an impact yet there.
I definitely remember it being like on the radio and stuff all the time. So it definitely hit at one point. But yeah, maybe a different time.
So jumping over to TV, reality TV was only slightly dominant, unlike it is, you know, in later years in the 2000s. It placed 3 shows in the top 10, including American Idol, which is taking up the first 2 spots, while Dancing with the Stars came in 7th. The top scripted shows were Grey's Anatomy in 3rd, followed by 2.5 Men, House, and Desperate Housewives. The top 10 wrapped up with Lost, Fringe, and Law and Order. Did you watch Fringe?
No, I've never seen Fringe. No.
You've never seen Fringe, so never made it to.
I've heard of it, but I've not watched it.
Yeah, I mean, definitely in that X-Files, you know, realm, because it's about an alternate universe that crossed over with our universe. I was a huge fan when it started. I was kind of surprised to see it in the top 10 because it always felt like one of those little cult shows that you know, only a small group of nerds watched. And so like, and you know, like the X-Files and those Friday night Fox shows. I mean, I don't know, where did X-Files, did you watch X-Files on TV?
I watched it growing up, yeah.
Where did it air in Scotland? Like what channel picked it up?
So to start with, it was on BBC One or Two, which is like one of our main 5 channels that we had at the time. I think getting towards the end it maybe moved over to Sky, like satellite TV, which I think we had it by then, so we probably watched it. But yeah, to start with, it used to be on like 9 o'clock on like a Monday night or something, or a Thursday night, because I remember watching like the first few seasons of it. I think it was the same with Buffy did the same. It went from like BBC and then it snuck away to Sky so we could finish watching it. Yeah, it was pretty big over here, definitely when it started anyway.
Yeah, I couldn't find Scottish rankings for TV. So what do most people watch in Scotland? What's the top of the charts in Scotland?
I mean, I think we're probably the same as like the rest of Britain. Like we kind of have, there's like 5 kind of main channels that are just literally called 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Like there's nothing fancy about it. And then we just get a bunch of kind of extra channels through like Freeview now, so we kind of have like 30 or 40 core channels, and then you get extra stuff as well. So yeah, I think most people probably just watch the main kind of 5 they're the big guys. That's where most of the kind of new stuff airs, and then Sky has like Sky One, and I think that gets a lot of the like kind of fancier like American stuff, and then we eventually get it on other channels. But yeah, I think there's such a mix of stuff now, like compared to when I was younger. It's maybe difficult to tell, and then all the streaming stuff added on top of it to know what to watch.
Do people watch more reality shows? Because I know a lot of reality shows came from Europe, and then were eventually adapted into American television. Is reality television still strong in European television, especially Scotland? Or is it a mix of, like, are there Scottish sitcoms and drama shows?
Yeah, there's Scottish soap operas. There's like one called River City that's set in Glasgow. There's like comedies and things like Still Game and things called Chewing the Fat and stuff. They're like Scottish specific. There is a BBC Scotland channel which has a lot of the Scottish specific stuff on it. But yeah, there is still a lot of reality TV over here. Love Island's absolutely huge. it just started like last week, and that's all like anyone that I speak to is talking about. And then I think Big Brother's like still going, and things like The X Factor and like Britain's Got Talent and I'm a Celebrity and The Jungle, like there's tons of reality. I think it's kind of died down the last year because it's a bit harder to do that because of the
COVID, yeah,
pandemic, but it seems to all be coming back now. So yeah, there is still tons of that. But yeah, the Scottish stuff's very specific. They show stuff in England that's Scottish, like I don't have the thickest Scottish accent. There's like my boyfriend's Glaswegian and his accent's a lot thicker, but when they show Scottish stuff like in England, they sometimes have to put subtitles up just at what we're saying. So yeah, it's a wee bit of a niche market.
Is there anything you've seen from reality television that like is particularly weird lately, something new that we should be on the watch out because it'll eventually end up here in America?
There was a thing, I think it was like last year, actually, but it was called Killer Camp, and it was kind of a bit like Love Island mixed with like Friday the 13th.
Oh my goodness.
Went into like a Americanized kind of campground, but it was British contestants, and they had like a killer in like a hockey mask that went round, and if you got voted out, they like staged this big death scene killer where he like came and brutally murdered you, and it was brilliant. Like, I'm not the biggest fan of reality TV, but I watched every episode of that. It was amazing. So I'm kind of hoping they do another one because it was so much fun. And it randomly just have the killer, like people would be having serious conversations about their like blossoming romances and stuff, and suddenly this guy would just pop up at the window with a machete and they would all like freak out and like run away. It was so funny. If you can ever watch Killer Camp somewhere, I would highly recommend it because it was bananas.
Oh, I'm sure it'll make its way over here at some point.
I hope so.
That sounds like something that people will want to watch. So we jump over to the box office. The Chaos Experiment opened on two screens in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where the film was shot. In its first weekend, it sold 225 tickets. Not great. Great. No. A representative of the theater that showed the film said, "There are two issues with the movie. One, it has little to no marketing, and two, the content of the movie is not for everyone." So obviously it did not make it into the top 10 this weekend.
No.
I mean, you never hear about a movie theater actually saying, "Hey, people don't want to watch this movie."
I know, that's not what you want. No,
not at all. So the box office was led by a pair of debuts which appealed to very different audiences. The first one was X-Men Origins Wolverine, which I was amazed when I saw this. It earned a remarkable $102 million in its opening weekend. Wow. And then people realized it wasn't good. I mean, I don't think that's anybody's favorite X-Men film. I can't imagine that's anybody's favorite. And yet $102 million, that's the power of Wolverine, at least at the time. I mean, I can't imagine. That's so many tickets.
My God, yeah.
Did you ever see X-Men Origins?
I've seen it, yeah. I didn't go and see it in the cinema, but I have seen it, though I was working it recently, that I think I've maybe... Is there three? I think there's three separate Wolverine films, isn't there? There's like two and there's Logan. I think I've not seen like the middle one, maybe.
The Wolverine,
I was debating a like marathon on Disney Plus of them all to make sure I've seen them all, because I love the X-Men films. They're like, even the like ones that people are like X-Men 3 and stuff, people are terrible. I'm like, no, they're brilliant. I love them. So.
I can't agree with you on X-Men 3.
This is so much fun. It's banana. But yeah,
I enjoy the X-Men. I mean, for me, it's First Class is my favorite. Class, I think it's fantastic.
I do like the kind of newer kind of generation-y ones. I've not seen Dark Phoenix yet. I think maybe the only newer one I haven't seen.
Yeah, you give me James McAvoy and Michael Fassbender, and I'm a happy guy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But yeah, no, I definitely did see it. I just didn't see it in the cinema, so I was not one of those.
One of those 102, yeah.
No, yeah.
So just behind Wolverine in second place with a meager $82.8 million. I mean, this is crazy. $82.8 million, it's a rom-com. It's Matthew McConaughey's Ghosts of Girlfriends Past. $82 million.
Wow.
Like, what rom-com makes money like that nowadays?
That's impressive.
Yeah. I mean, when you consider $102 million worth of tickets were sold for X-Men, like, I have to, like, say, like, well, maybe people went to see two movies in one day on that weekend, and they saw X-Men, and then they saw Ghosts of Girlfriends Past. That's insane to me that a rom-com could make $82 million in one weekend.
Yeah, that is, yeah, especially like one weekend, like not even just like this whole run. Like, that's, yeah. That's
behind it was the thriller Obsessed, starring Beyonce, Idris Elba, and Ali Larder. Then 17 again with Zac Efron. And then the Jamie Foxx, Robert Downey Jr. film, The Soloist. Do you remember The Soloist?
No.
Yeah, I don't think most people do. It was about a homeless violin player. And very unusual film, but you know, it's Robert Downey Jr., so. It was entertaining. He's always good in everything. Yeah. Maybe not Doolittle. Doolittle was not so great. But you know, most of the time he's a solid bet. They were followed by the animated adventure Monsters vs. Aliens, which was in its sixth week in theaters, followed by the Disney documentary Earth, which is nice to see a documentary in the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Channing Tatum film Fighting, which I have no memory of. Do you know Fighting?
No, is that the one that this is going to help because I can't remember anyone's names, but I was going to say, is that the one where the guy from The Office is in it, but he's wearing like a lot of makeup and it doesn't look like him?
I don't know for sure. It's about street fighting. It's about a street fighting film. And I mean, Channing Tatum was, I think, a relatively big deal at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And for him to have a film that was in the top 10 and I have no memory of it, that's weird. Like, I'm always fascinated by these films that just slip in and then disappear. People spent tons of money, tons of effort, and they just vanished. Like, nobody cares about these films.
No, I know, yeah.
Yeah, the top 10 wrapped up with Hannah Montana, the movie, and and State of Play, which was another film I don't remember. Do you know State of Play?
No, I don't think so.
So this was a political journalism film. It starred Russell Crowe, Rachel McAdams, and Ben Affleck. I mean, I looked at the reviews. They were all very positive. And again, just, you could say State of Play to almost anybody, and they'd be like, what? Is that a movie? Was that a play, perhaps?
I was clearly too busy watching the Hannah Montana movie.
Well, I guess everybody's busy watching Matthew McConaughey and Hugh Jackman, so who could have time for Ben Affleck? Well, we're going to take a little break, and then we'll be right back to talk about the Chaos Experiment, or maybe the Steam Experiment. We'll decide when we come back. Welcome back to KilmerCast. Let's get into this film. The Chaos Experiment, or the Steam Experiment, as it's also known, which is an odd thing to have two film titles that are basically very similar. You know, the idea that I know the film is about Steam, and I know in the movie, the book says the Chaos Experiment. So why, could you imagine why they would go back and forth between two titles? Like, what's the point?
I at least get the logic of the Chaos Experiment, because that's what he was literally... trying to experiment with. But the Steam Experiment, like, the Steam really, I don't know, it makes it sound like that was a core part of the experiment. Really, it was just put people anywhere where they would die if you leave them long enough, and that was going to get the same results. So I feel like the Chaos Experiment is a better title. The Steam Experiment is just a bit like, okay. I don't really understand. I saw that when I got Letterboxd up to like log it after I'd watched it, and I was like, oh, it's also called the Steam Experiment. That's a strange choice. I'm not really sure why they went. It doesn't make it sound like sexier or more exciting to be like, oh, no. Steam's involved. Like, it's very silly.
Well, it was written by Robert Malcani. It was the third of three films that he's written to date, including a decently reviewed drama called Day Zero, which is a military drama, which seems to have gotten some good press. It had some festival screenings. and then the internet themed serial killer film Dot Kill, which is actually very similar to this film. It's a, you know, because you have the whole, we'll talk more about, there's a camera element to this film and people being, you know, essentially stalked, but that one didn't do quite as well. He's not been heard of since 2009. This was his last film, as far as anybody can tell. And that's probably for a reason, as we'll find out as we talk. handling the directing duties was Philippe Martinez, who is known more as a producer of direct-to-video films. He does films with like Jean-Claude Van Damme and Steven Seagal, just top of the charts, you know. he's directed four other films, none of which are held in particularly high regard, although 2004's Wake of Death got some good reviews on IMDb for its action scenes. We should talk about a little bit more about Martinez, because he has a very odd IMDb entry. He has five completed films listed with no release dates. Nobody has five films just sitting there. That's a very strange thing to have. And he also has another pair of films in just like in like pre-production or filming, like super prolific, but not somebody that you're like, oh yeah, I know Philippe Martinez. That's just, I'm a big fan. That doesn't happen. I think part of it is that he has a record of legal problems. He was accused multiple times of fraud, and he actually spent six months in France in jail for fraud. So not the greatest record with him. Also, it should be, when you consider that kind of record, it should be no surprise that he's friends and collaborators with Steve Bannon, who was one of the architects of the Trump presidency. Steve Bannon was actually a producer on this film. So when you look at this film, you say, okay, this is made by somebody who's not quite right. We understand that why there were problems with this movie. So usually a film will use its opening scene to establish like a mood or a setting, you know, really get you into what's going on here. This film just establishes a sense of total confusion right off the bat. I mean, we start off at this mental hospital in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I know that Americans have a really poor sense of geography of the rest of the world. Do you have an idea about Michigan and what it's all about?
No, I have a vague sense of some American states, but it's usually ones that like I know where Maine is because of Stephen King and Murder, She Wrote, and like that's kind of my knowledge. So no, go ahead.
Yeah, so Michigan is right like in the middle and on the north top of the border of Canada with America. And it's a pretty big state. This film takes place in Grand Rapids, which is one of the bigger cities outside of Detroit. Detroit, Michigan is the biggest city. That's where the auto industry lives. But the Grand Rapids is a pretty big and a big, posh area. Like it has money in Grand Rapids. Mm-hmm. And so you can see in this film that there's a lot of big buildings, a lot of, you know, interesting hotels and stuff like that. So we start off at a mental hospital there, and then we jump back 5 hours.
Yeah.
You can't do that in your first 10 seconds of the film. You can't jump back 5 hours when you've established nothing.
No, I know. I said that when I was watching it, I went, ooh, it's because it said 5 hours later to start with. And I went, ooh, 5 hours later from what? Like, and then it went back and I was like, okay, we're gonna find out. But yeah, no, there's no, yeah, I thought something was gonna happen in the hospital, like some, I don't know, him trying to break out or him like mumbling about all of the trauma he'd seen or whatever, and there was just nothing. It was just him lying on a bed. Oh, and I think a shot of a merry-go-round.
Yeah, let's talk about the merry-go-round, because we have Kilmer, like you said, in bed with a bandage on his head. So something went on, something happened. He's like comatose. He's basically catatonic laying in this bed. But then we get shots of a carousel moving in slow motion. And at times he's on the carousel, standing still, spinning around on this carousel. Can you think of any, and obviously I don't care about spoilers of this film. We're going to talk about everything in this movie. Does this relate to anything in the film in the end?
I mean, no, not that I can think of. I was trying to make some connection about just the general like chaos of it, looking like, because he's standing kind of still and everything's flying around about him, all the lights and the horses and things, but that was the tenuous is link. I thought it was going to come up later.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to connect back to something like in his past, like maybe he'd seen his wife murdered on a carousel or something, like, but there's just nothing. I think it just made a kind of cool looking shot, and carnival music, like distorted, always sounds a bit creepy, and they just kind of lent into that randomly throughout the film for no reason.
Yeah, and I think that really, like you said, it doesn't connect to anything in the film, but it does connect to the style of filmmaking in this film, because it really is trying to be super stylized. everything is with weird lens effects and odd coloring and slow motion, and there's no reason for it. This film uses style for no effect.
It's just confusing. There's like the part where they're especially when they're in the sauna and they're all kind of introducing themselves. I was trying to write down like who the character names were and like something I would remember about them, because it's very hard to see everyone. There's this really like bright yellow, it kind of looks like someone's just smeared like butter on the lens of the camera. Yeah, it's really confusing because there's one bit where one girl's speaking, but they're showing a shot of her sitting there not speaking, and I was like, oh, so that's not her. But then it was her, and I was like, I had to watch it like three times to get, I was like, right, get everyone's character names. So yeah, they're trying to be like a bit zany with their shots and things, but it just ends up being completely confusing. I mean, it's a bit cool to look at, but I don't think it has any like real substance to it. It just makes it quite hard to follow the plot, which isn't like the steam room section plot isn't that hard to follow. It's really all the stuff that's happening.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think they maybe should have called it the confusing experiment. That would have fit well.
I know, right?
So after the shots of the carousel, we have Kilmer at a hotel, and this movie jumps around like crazy. It really tries to be nonlinear, and we'll talk more about how that affected the film, because it really ruined everything, because you can't tell what's happening half the time. But it's such a slow start to this film. Nothing happens for almost 5 minutes, and then suddenly we have a shot of people screaming with no establishment. Like, they're just screaming in swimsuits, and you're like, wait, what? Like, where did this come from? I mean, I get wanting to create an offsetting, you know, maybe shake up the viewer, but you have to establish some sort of construction, some sort of, you know, boundaries to where are we, what are we looking at? Otherwise it's just, like you said, confusing.
I don't think, I think if they were going to go for that approach, they shouldn't have tried to put any chronology in to start with. The fact that they've gone like, 5 hours earlier.
Yeah.
But then they just mess it up. You're like, well, which 5 hours? I'm not really sure. And I was so confused at the original, the meeting. I wrote down in my notes, I was like, he's meeting Eric Roberts at a hotel. And then in brackets, I wrote dating service ? Because I was like, it's what he said. Like, that doesn't sound right. Like, what's that got to do with anything? There's just no... I feel like there should have been, a bit more build up to kind of explain that he was being a bit sneaky, because at the time you're like, oh, well, that sounds legitimate, and then he's away at a newspaper.
Yeah, just jumped right from that, where you see them in the hotel. Eric Roberts is in this film also with Val Kilmer, and they're talking about the hotel, which apparently is going to be renovated into luxury condos when they're done doing whatever they're doing, which is apparently related, like you said, to a dating service. And Roberts seems to be one of his clients. And so we're like, okay, what? You know, we've now gone through a hotel, a mental hospital, a carousel, people screaming in swimsuits, and now we've got a dating service. This movie just throws so much at you. And then suddenly, now we're at a newspaper.
Yep.
I was like, wait, what happened? Why did you do all that? And now we're in a totally different setting. And Val Kilmer's there again. Like, what is the order of what's happening in this film?
It literally seems like he drops Eric Roberts off at the hotel and then goes to the, like, that's the way it feels like. It feels like he's had that meeting with him and then been like, oh, I've got to nip out because I've got to go and speak to this newspaper guy. And it's not even, I think, when he walks into the office, it's not even like very obviously like a newspaper building until the guy that he speaks to reception goes, oh, that's the editor in chief.
Oh yeah, I love that little exposition there. You know, just in case, so that we know exactly who he's talking to. Oh, that's the editor in chief. Nobody talks like that.
Like, I'm sure he would know who the editor in chief was as well without looking it up in like the staff directory. Like, I feel like that would just be knowledge. Yeah, they should have just had, I don't know why they didn't have a big sign or like the classic, just like everyone working away on computers and shouting at each other, that kind of thing. They just,
just put a sign on his door that has his name, editor in chief, all set. Well, we find out that this guy, Val Kilmer's character, is James Pettis. At least we think it is. Mm-hmm. So James Pettis wants to speak, like you said, to the editor in chief. And he tells Walter, who's the editor in chief, who I actually like this guy. Like, he's a good actor. I mean, like, I'm he's only in the film a little bit, but I enjoyed his performance here. I wish I wrote down his name, but kudos to you, Mr. Walter. So he tells Walter he wants to save the world. And so Walter's like, well, you know what? I'm busy. Write a letter to the editor. I'll put you in the newspaper, make it juicy. But then Pettis says, well, in 2 hours, 6 people are going to die. So now, okay, finally we have what's happening in this movie. Mm-hmm. So we have some sort of hostage situation. great. I mean, that's all I think we're now 15 minutes into this film, though, and we finally figured out that Pettis is not a great guy and he's got some hostages. So, okay, wonderful. Except the film says, you know what? We've been in one spot for a little too long right now. We're going to jump to a bar now and meet Jack, who's played by Armando Santé. I mean, this film has a legitimately solid cast, which is easily the most disappointing part of this film, is that you have solid performers in a mess of a film.
Yep.
So we meet him at the bar for literally like a split second. All he has the opportunity to do is flirt with the bartender for a second, and then we're gone. We're back to the newspaper. Why? Why did we need that scene?
I think they were very much at pains to try and set him up as like a womanizer. That was I've got a date, I need to go. And like when he's wrapped it all up at the end, he's like, thank goodness I can make my date. Like, it just seemed to be like they just wanted to make him to be this like sexy policeman. And so, yeah, they had to.
How successful do you think that was?
No, I don't. not at all. We didn't seem particularly smooth. I might have to see him actually go off with someone at the end and have a sort of glimpse of his like happy life or whatever, but yeah, it was a bit strange. It was like trying to give him, it's like we don't have time to give him much characterization, so let's just put something in like he's good with the women and then that'll be it, that'll be enough. Like, he has a life outside the police force. But yeah, he like turns up at the police, he seems like he's like half drunk when he turns up at the,
oh yeah,
because he's been like sloshing martinis. Then he drives Val Kilmer around for like a solid 10 minutes just in the back of his car. So it's not the best police.
No, world. Not at all.
It's a strange one.
So Walter called Jack in, and so Jack comes and gets Pettis, and they're talking about, you know, what, why has he six people? And so now we're in like the, he's in custody essentially. And so he's trying to figure out what's going on here. And Pettis says, this is all about climate change and how the world will end in 2012. And by the way, this film was 2009, and he's saying the world's going to end in 3 years. And that's why he has six people hostage. Okay, I know in the end, it means nothing. Mm. Like, and we'll establish that right now. Nothing in this film means anything in the end. But like, why? Why make this the crux of this film, that climate change is why he has people hostage? It seems like an unnecessary little detail here.
I know. I feel like they were trying to go down the like kind of Saw route and give the killer like a bit of a like moral high ground to be standing on. So it was kind of like, I'm potentially torturing six people to death to save the rest of you. But it was a strange one, because I'm pretty sure if we were 3 years away from dying from like climate change, I don't think we'd be able to fix it in 3 years. Like, I think that's us, we're probably done. So yeah, I don't know, it could have just it was a strange one. And I feel like as well, if he did have like actual research on climate change, it'd probably be pretty easy just to get it published, rather than,
he does have books that he shows them. And so it's like, it's just very frustrating, because again, in the end, it means nothing, because none of this actually ties to anything else in the film. It was just a reason at the beginning to make him seem like he was, had a reason, that it wasn't just ridiculous.
Yeah, I think they were just like, they clearly wanted a reason to have the main characters like sweaty and in swimsuits for the entire film. So they were like, well, like the planet's getting hotter, a sauna's hot, let's connect them. Like, I feel like that was the only thing. There was no real, there's no real logical reason. It was just a way to get them into a steam room and kind of make it have a connection, I guess,
but it doesn't work. So we jump from there back to bed again. We have the carousel, and now we finally meet the people who are in the steam room. Okay, this scene goes on forever.
Oh my God.
You told me this scene was 2 hours long, I would say yes, sure, I agree, because like this, there's such padding, such stretching of every piece of information, every moment. Let's talk about the six people in this room. So the six people who apparently are part of this dating service that James Pettis has set up meet in a steam room. They come one at a time, and we get very stereotype introductions to each one of them. So we'll talk about Frank first. Frank owns an Italian restaurant in Brooklyn, which, I mean, immediately he talks with the most unbelievably stereotyped Brooklyn accent. He is just awful, just an awful person, top to bottom.
Yep. And he manages to say, forget about it, like, I'm not even gonna try the accent, but he manages to get that in like his four lines of introduction.
Oh, please try it.
I'm not I thought of it in my head and I was like, no, don't even try. It'll just come out terrible.
I think I kind of want to hear a Scottish take on Forget About It.
Oh, I'm sure I would offend so many people. But yeah, they cram so much stereotype into him in like the couple of minutes, because he gets annoyed at one of the women for implying that he's in the mafia, but then he just fully leans into the...
Exactly. At one point he says he likes chicks who know what they like. I'm like, come on, like, this guy is the worst. He's so just one-sided. It's just, it's awful, brutal. And they put him in this like zebra print Speedo just to raise the level of awfulness just that much higher.
Yeah.
Then we have Eric Roberts' character, who is Grant. He is a former football player professional football player from Texas. And he tells at one point a story about his Southern parents that I was like, what, like, how did you just take Tennessee Williams and try to like, like say, let's how far can we push this to make it completely unbelievable? What did you think of Grant, Eric Roberts? Because again, somebody who is a legitimate actor, who does a lot of bad films though.
Yeah, no, I was thinking that. I'm trying to think, there was something I saw him in recently that was terrible and I can't remember what it is, but it was lodged in my head of like, oh yeah, this is not probably the mark of quality. No, I thought he was actually fine, because probably because he was one of the best actors, and he seemed the most logical up until the point where he suddenly just stopped being logical. It just turned off like instantly. But to start with, he was like trying to calm Frank down, like giving him a hug and stuff, and being like, don't freak out on us, like we need to. And he was the one being very logical, being like, look, we've got a massage booked after this and we've got dinner, like someone's gonna come and get us. So I think he was probably one of the most likable to start, until he switches later on for no apparent reason, because he just seemed to be just trying to deal with it in like the calmest way possible, unlike everyone else.
Yeah, and then there's Christopher, who is a nurse from Pennsylvania, who we learn his wife died in a car accident 9 months ago. Mm-hmm. We don't get a whole lot more from Christopher.
Yeah, he was super forgettable. I had it in my notes, and then I kept being like, because most of the time when it went to the shots, it was either like Frank being angry or just like the women, and I was like, I can't even remember until like people die and he's like the only guy left. I was like,
yeah.
I remember it. Yeah, he's super forgettable. He doesn't really do much apart from get a nail gun through his hand.
Yeah, which we have to talk about, because I have a lot of questions about how that possibly happened. Mm-hmm. So then we have the three women. So we'll start with Margaret, who is she's a winner. She works for a small publisher in Connecticut, and she's from California, but she likes living the life of a neurotic, struggling, fucked up romance writer. I mean, could they give her more little like quirky bits to like work with here, like to make her personality more on the edge, because she really is a frayed knot, you know, like right from the beginning, she is going to break immediately.
Yeah. I know they piled so much on her. And also I feel like her and Jesse, I don't know why they were there. Like they didn't seem like they wanted to be anywhere near any other people. Like both of them were just like, so I don't know why they were at a dating service thing. It seemed very silly. But yeah, they just the fact that like Margaret instantly starts having a panic attack and everything, and she's just instantly goes into like fight or flight mode. Yeah, they really piled it on with her. Like I feel like you would not introduce yourself like that to people you've just met. It's so much information. And again, that was a really confusing shots of like everyone's faces and her sitting just looking panicked but not talking over her voiceover.
Yeah, I wrote down everybody's descriptions and then tried to match names to the descriptions, because you could, like you said before, you could not figure that out from the way they shot it.
No, it was not until later where they started shouting at Jesse. And I was like, oh, she's Jesse.
Yes, absolutely.
So I had to go back and scribble it out. But yeah, well, every character is very, they just lay on the kind of stereotypes of what they're going to be. Like, I don't know why I had to do the experiment. It was quite obvious what I was going to say, really, from just their introductions.
Yeah, because then you have Catherine, who's an actress or former actress, as she makes clear, from Manhattan, who she likes falling in love, but she hates when it ends. So I'm like, come on. These are literally out of a casting note, like just ridiculous descriptions. There's not much to Catherine. She just screams a lot. She does a lot of screaming.
She is the only woman that seemed like she wanted to be there. Mm-hmm. The whole like falling in love stuff, it kind of gave off that air. But yeah, again, she is a bit forgettable. She just kind of stands on the sidelines at the start and doesn't do a lot. Like there's a bit later where like Jesse's getting attacked and she literally just stands and screams at the guy, like rather than do anything.
Yeah, you're not a help.
No, I was gonna say if that was Jesse when I stood up, I would have been so annoyed at her. So yeah.
Yeah. And then let's talk about Jessie, because as you mentioned her, she's a waitress from Atlanta, originally from Detroit, I believe, who likes money and hates guys who take advantage of women. So why is she there? Like you said, she is so standoffish. She gives them the finger, like, and then out of nowhere, she takes off her top. Yeah. Why? Like, I understand why for the film, because they wanted to put some breasts in the film.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason this happens, because she does not want any of these guys to look at her, touch her, anything, but she is going to sit there with her top off and basically just like act like, you know, this is not unusual.
I know, I feel like they kind of tried to do it a bit of like she's very body confident and she's like, I'm going to take my top off, but you're never going to get me. But it did come across a bit of like she just disliked, because it was like Frank that was mostly leading her, she disliked him so much, like why would she even
try
that? Like it seemed like it was trying to be like a power play, but it didn't really work because she was so disliked all the men. You don't think she would even attempt that. It just seemed very strange. Yeah, they were clearly just trying to work out how they could get boobs into the film naturally, and that's what they went with.
And they did it, because she is topless for a good 5 minutes for no reason. Even her posing is ridiculous. Like, why would she lean on her elbows that way instead of just laying on the bench, which is what I think most people in a sauna would do, would just lay down. You don't lean on your elbows to arch your back to push your breasts forward to guys that you don't want to have look at you.
I know, it's not even remotely subtle. It's just very
just ridiculous.
I know.
Well, as this is all happening, finally we've ended all these marathon introductions. We're back with Jack and Walter, and Jack is trying to figure out the background hero for Pettis, who was a professor and a writer, and they find this guy named Raymond Gregory, who actually might be Pettis. And so now, if this movie wasn't confusing enough, now he has two identities. So awesome. We're just going to pile on the confusion in this film. And I don't think the film does a good job of explaining what this all means, because at points I was like, wait, who is Raymond Gregory? I actually lost track of who was who and what they meant in the film.
Yeah, there's a bit at some point where the policeman who's like interviewing him comes out and the other policeman goes like, oh, we've worked out he's Raymond Gregory. And the other guy was like, yeah, I knew that. And I'm like, did you? Because I didn't. Like, where did you get? Okay. Well, let's go with it. I don't know if he was just trying to cover himself and make it look like he'd figured it out, or they really had like solidly figured it out and they just hadn't told. But they were like, oh yeah, we phoned his psychiatrist and that's who he is. Like,
that out so quickly?
How did they know who to phone as well if he was giving them a fake name? Because there's a bit where he said he used to work at the hotel where they think the sauna is, but then the sauna's been demolished, so it can't be. They find out like he's given a fake social security number and things, and I think that's how they track down who he really is, but I don't know.
None of it makes sense.
Well, I was gonna say, if they knew it was fake, I don't know how they then found the real information.
Exactly.
Especially if it's a fake name, fake social security. I have no idea how they connected those dots, but there's a woman police officer that seems to do most of the legwork. She just kind of comes in with information and like slams it down and then leaves again. Like, she's...
yeah, I think that's Sergeant Exposition.
Yeah. she seems to be the only one that's actually doing actual useful informational police work.
Yeah, and you mentioned the fact that they were at the hotel, but it's not there. The sauna that is supposed to be there is not there. It's being destroyed. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's jump back a bit. Kilmer meets Eric Roberts at this hotel, the Grand Hotel, and says, this is where we're going to do this dating thing. How did he get them to the sauna if it's not at that hotel?
Well, but that's the thing, isn't it? Like, because I'm not even sure when the whole sauna thing happened, to be honest. So did it happen before they demolished it? Like, because it looks like the same hotel. When he takes Eric Roberts in, and then when they come back later, it looks like the same hotel lobby. So I'm actually, if they did take them to another hotel, but then the other police officer like looks up every sauna and like, oh, they're all fine, there's no one There's no one having a torture game in them.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and I feel like if that is true, if that was like revealing that the game wasn't happening at the same time as the police interview stuff, it potentially gave that away quite early in the film, because it looks like the same hotel lobby. So it's very confusing.
Needed in the end was a layout of the chronology.
It needed a Saw style flashback where everything like flashes in the right order and then like someone slams a door and it's done. Like that's what it needed, and it didn't have that. It finishes on the most like bananas ending scene I've ever seen. And then actually when it finished, I like turned to my boyfriend and I was like, no, I don't know what's going on. And he didn't even I'll get to it later, but
So we'll go back now that Walter and Greg, Walter and Jack, and they're figuring out what's going on with this guy Pettis. We're back into the steam room and they realize now they're trapped because the door won't open. The rate at which they lose their minds is astonishing. They go from, okay, we're trapped, to Lord of the Flies in 5 seconds.
I know, it's like, I was thinking of like films like Cube and stuff where people are like trapped and they go like quite like turn on each other quite quickly. But in films like that, there's like active like murder traps and things that are killing people. So they see someone like dice into mince and then they're like, oh my goodness. And then they turn on each other. But in this, they're literally just potentially like somebody dropped a towel in front of the sauna door and it just won't open. And they're like murdering each other within about 5 minutes. I feel like, I don't know, I don't want to say that I feel like this film should have been longer. I maybe feel like they should have cut more at the start or something. But I think something should have happened to give them a bit more time to breathe before they went bananas, because that it seemed very unrealistic.
Oh, yeah, like, because the second one, the girl says, Jesse says, the door is locked, won't open. Frank loses his mind. He rips a pipe out of the ground. I don't know how he managed that one.
With his bare hands, his roasting hot pipe, he just rips it out with his bare hands.
And ends up strangling Jesse with the pipe. But then Margaret stabs him.
And what did she stab him with?
A piece of broken glass.
Okay, cool. I wasn't sure.
I think because Frank broke the window on the sauna, which, by the way, once you open up the window to the sauna, it's no longer a sauna because the steam can escape through that hole. It's a lot less dangerous now that there's a way out. So that's stupid to begin with. But she grabs a piece of the broken glass and stabs Frank and kills him. And so now Frank's dead. So like that went so quick. I was like, wow, I mean, not that I wasn't unhappy that he was gone because I was done with his character from the beginning, but the fact that she's now dead, he's dead, she's freaking out. I mean, where are we supposed to go from here? Because we've now gone to 11.
I know, because the person that's sort of like the antagonist within the contained situation usually lasts a bit longer. Like they usually actually kill one of the good guys first and things. I think they just pushed his character so far. Like the minute he went horrible, he was like, choking women. He was like calling them bitches about 8 times before he died. Like he was just trying to be as offensive as possible. I feel like there was nowhere to go but kill him. Like that was the thing. But yeah, I feel like, I don't know, something could have, I feel like they could have used them a bit more to be a bit more like evil in the sauna before they got rid of him. But I feel like Margaret's decision to kill him was quite justified, because otherwise he was just gonna kill Jesse.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think she shouldn't have killed him. It's just like, wow, you really went there right away. There's no reason for this in this film, because I mean, admittedly, he said it's not a very long film. It's 90 minutes at most, and which I appreciate, for sure appreciate. I'm a big fan of 90 minutes, especially when it's a terrible film. But it really left nothing to work from character development.
I know. I think that's probably why they had to make Eric Roberts' character maybe try and go a bit like evil later on, because they were like, oh, we've killed the evil guy.
Now what? Now there's no problem. We can all just hang out here.
Yeah, exactly. It was a strange one. They just went right in there with it. But yeah.
Terrible. They go back to the interrogation now with Armand DeSante and with Val Kilmer. I actually kind of like the scenes between them in the interrogation. You know, these are two good actors. There's no doubt that these are solid actors. And they actually have some good chemistry when they're facing off in the interrogation room. until Bettis decides, oh, I'm going to take advantage of this and slam my head into the table. And it's like, okay, we're now on another level because, you know, this is just wild. Because now, I mean, but they don't do anything with it because I assumed that Pettis's goal was to make it look like he was abused by Armand Asante, but nobody cares.
No.
In this world of this film, brutality is fine, apparently.
They were just like, how can we, they were clearly just like, how can we get an injury on Val Kilmer that we can show at the start of the film to like suggest some time has passed? Like, but there was no real significance to it actually happening, apart from after that, Val Kilmer kind of starts leaning into the more, like, he starts acting a lot crazier. Like, he went from being very just like chill, and then he starts being all like twitchy and whispering to himself and like banging his head and things, and it just kind of escalates until the being a bit comatose at the end, like we saw at the beginning. But yeah, I think it's just I can just kind of use it as like a bit of a break in his character, because he's been quite chill up until then, of just asking to get, just casually being like, oh, I might murder six people, put me in the paper. That kind of shows, I guess, like he does have the potential underneath to be a bit violent and strange, but yeah, nothing really happens with it.
No,
so it's a bit
like most things in this film. Nothing happens with it.
Doesn't go anywhere.
So back in the room, in the steam room, they've got the window open. So they decide, we're going to take Jessie and put her head through the window, which immediately to me is a problem because there's broken glass in there. You're going to hurt her probably anyway. What are you going to accomplish? Let's see. Let's put her through the window, and then somebody shoots her with a nail gun through the forehead, and she's dead. And then somebody shoots Christopher through the hand with a nail gun. Okay. So, as I said before, spoilers be damned. Who is shooting them? What's happening? Because, as you know, we'll learn later, people in the room are involved in this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Who is doing this damage? Because is it Pettis? And when is that happening? Because all we see is that there's the interrogation, the people in the room. Like, this was the annoyance of this timeline in this film, is that nothing really lines up well.
Yeah, I do feel like they needed that kind of just explanation dump at the end to try and figure it out, because I kind of assumed that it was Pettis and that the game was happening at a different time to his interview, because he was just sitting there at one point and like he was like, oh, one of them's dead, and I was like, how do you know that?
Yes, I hated that.
Yeah, like they find the camera and stuff, and I was like, but that doesn't matter because he's still in a police room, like even if there is a camera, it doesn't make any sense. So I kind of assumed that it was meant to be him, and if it wasn't, I'm annoyed that they didn't explain that, because they kind of, yeah, like you said, they explain that other people are involved. It would have just been really easy to just tell us who that was. I like the fact that he was prepared with like a little circle of wood and a nail gun, the way he was like, to break this window, I'm sorry.
Like, his planning is perfect.
Yeah, he could have just done that in the first place when he locked the door. He could have just done that, and then that would have avoided a lot of it, because surely him killing Jessie or whoever killed her, it's not very like ideal experimental conditions. That's like an outside factor coming in the face of the nail gun.
And beyond that, like you said, the experimental conditions, as we learn in the end, only four people in this experiment were actually subjects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are you going to learn from that? if two people are in the situation manipulating it, essentially, and you have another one outside of it manipulating it, and only four people are actually a part of it, and two of them are dead immediately, what are you learning?
I know, God. Yeah, it doesn't... I'm gonna have to stop saying it doesn't make sense, because I'm just gonna be saying that all the time. But I probably don't want to get at the end now, but I really didn't understand, apart from the whole, just the angle of the like, oh, there was people involved the whole time, I didn't really understand the logic of that. But yeah, it was very strange. It was strange, especially because, like, I think when Christopher had his arm and stuff through the door, he was trying to use the pipe to block the door. He was clearly tall enough to probably just have his head through the door. He didn't have to like four-man lift anybody like through with just their head. That seemed like a strange choice.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I think if I thought I'd been locked in a sauna and I saw someone coming, I'd probably like go inside,
pull back.
It was the person who locked me in, because
exactly.
there's clearly something wrong with them. She just screams in their face and then gets... I do appreciate a nail gun death, though. They pop up quite a lot in horror films and they're always fun. So I was quite into that.
It's quite the weapon, a nail gun. It really... Yeah. There's no defending.
It's like a noise. It's like a... And then just like stuck in her head. Brilliant.
Well, we come back. Now that Jesse's dead and Frank's dead, we get this just unbelievably overwrought montage in the steam room. This scene literally lasts 5 minutes. I clocked it. And it's just them in the room set to opera. There's an opera song plays. And there's just fades and blurs. And they're just in various states of distress. Mm-hmm. And in the end, Margaret slits her own throat.
Yeah.
Why? Why? I mean, I get that she's neurotic. I get that she's freaking out. Why would you slit your own throat? Like, what is the point? Like, what do you, like, you have to think that at some point you're going to possibly get out of this, or at least something's going to, you know, you have a chance, but you're, because you have still have these other people with you. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the thing. You still have what you think are people who are working with you who mm-hmm. would possibly help you. You were able to kill one of the guys, so you have the chance to survive. Mm-hmm. Why did you kill yourself by slitting your throat? And why did she freak out so bad like that? Like, she goes wide-eyed and loses her mind.
Yeah, I know. I would love to get like a timer on when this happens, because Val Kilmer keeps saying like, oh, 2 hours and like your eyes all liquefy and your lungs all like melt and things. So clearly everything that happens in the sauna is within those 2 hours. So what, are they like 45 minutes in when she slits their own throat? Like, I just, I don't know. I think you think the prospect of dying or potentially like dehydration and overheating might be a more, like, if you were going to be like, just give up and let yourself die rather than actually slit your own throat. Yeah, I'm not really, I mean, yeah, apart from just like them horribly stereotyping people who have like a bit of mental illness going on and them just really like leading into that and being like, well, I think it was just because Val Kilmer kept saying things like, some people will turn on each other and some people will kill themselves. And they were just like, well, we've got to have someone who does that to make his speech make sense. But it does seem incredibly extreme. She didn't even like, people in horror films usually like sacrifice themselves to save someone else. They're like, I don't care about me, but you guys should live, or something. She didn't. She just.
She also never said a word about it. Like, you have other people in the room with you. You could say, you know, I can't keep doing this. You know, you could express, but because this 5 minute wordless scene set to opera, we're supposed to accept that it's her inner turmoil that we're watching play out. But you would, I think, say, I can't do this anymore before you kill yourself.
Yeah.
I can't say I'm an expert on suicide or anything like that, but like, usually you make a statement with your suicide. You make a cry for help or a protest out of it. She did nothing. It was just like, oh, here we go. Pew, and done.
I know, it's very strange. It was like, I don't think she says very much in general, apart from that very word heavy opening introduction. Like, I don't remember her saying very much because she's kind of in a panic attacky state and then just looking very wide-eyed and things. So they maybe didn't want to ruin it by giving her any more dialogue, but she just goes for it, and then that's it. They're clearly just trying to get the kills in as quickly as possible. And with the evil guy gone, like, who's gonna kill people? Yeah.
So we're left now with Grant, Christopher, and Catherine. Mm-hmm. And now the paranoia sets in because you have a three people team, and Roberts thinks that Catherine and Christopher are working together. At this point, Catherine then reaches through a hole in the wall and gets shocked by electricity. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, and we might as well reveal it right now for anybody who hasn't seen the film. Catherine and Christopher are the ones behind all this. Mm-hmm. They have locked these people in this room, even though they're in the room, by working with Pettis to make this happen. Why would she electrocute herself?
I know, yeah, because it's not even like it's not even like we just see it from her point of view and she like fakes it or something. We see her hand in the wires and all the sparks and everything, so it definitely happens.
Yeah.
This whole scene is insane though, because like they weirdly have Roberts's character explaining stuff that's happened but we haven't seen, because he's like, oh, like 5 minutes ago she said there was a camera and then you just put your hand in there and then there's a camera, but then, and then it shows that action and I'm like, why didn't you just
show us that?
Yeah. let us build the paranoia with him instead of him just suddenly going really angry and then us having to like do these mini flashbacks. And then yeah, he suddenly breaks the head off one of the weird like steam dragons and there's a little camera inside. It just went a bit, again, it's like they don't want to do the build up, they just want to go right to the actions. So they were like, let's just have Eric Roberts hate everyone, I want to kill people. The whole she gets electrocuted and then
what is the point of having her be electrocuted at that point? She knows what's going on in this room, or unless Catherine is not fully in on it and Christopher set this up and he was willing to risk her dying from electrocution. Because her getting shocked doesn't prove anything to anybody. Like, I understand if you were trying to trick other people into thinking that she was a part of the experiment instead of being behind it, then maybe you do something where she gets hurt. But who are you proving this to at this point? It's just Grant. You are two against one at that point. You don't need to prove anything. It's over.
I'm not entirely sure. I think it's just a bit of like, they kind of never give them both the chance to gang up on him, because like she gets electrocuted and then Grant knocks Christopher out and then he starts trying to drown Catherine. And then Christopher's all just like lying on the floor. So there's a lot of like, I guess giving him a chance to kind of fight them. But it's just weird because we never see anything. We never really see anything that suggests that they're working together, that he says they're maybe potentially in a relationship, or maybe he thinks Catherine's maybe in a relationship with Pettis. Because at one point he's like, Pettis, I'm coming for your woman. And then tries to drown her in what must be like boiling hot water.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Even though he's like, there's a bit as well where he's, Eric Roberts is in that water, just like chilling out, and he's doing a speech, but halfway through the speech, he's standing outside, like walking around the room, and then he's back
in the water.
And I'm just like, I don't even know. I don't know what's going on. It's so confusing.
This film was not winning any editing awards.
No, they just let someone go mad with the editing suite, and they didn't really think about what it was going to look like. But I'm not sure. I think they just wanted like a little bit more drama with Catherine getting drowned. But then she kills him anyway. Like
she beats the hell out of him.
Because there's that bit of stone that you see like fall in the water like earlier on. And I was like, oh, that's going to be significant. And then she gets it and, bashes his head in. And then Stiffer, because he just sat there and watched her nearly get murdered.
Yeah, I did appreciate that they utilized the stone from before. Mm-hmm. At least they followed through on that.
Yeah, that's the one time they thought about the chronology properly and actually actually used it.
So now Grant's dead, Catherine and Christopher are left in the room, and the hospital's at the police station to pick up Pettis, who has been in treatment for 4 months. Okay, 4 months. Mm-hmm. 4 months. So when did this happen?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was trying to work it out because, Christopher's like a doctor at the hospital. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Catherine's anything
she's in the room.
She's just in love with Christopher. So I was trying to figure out if it was a thing of, did they know each other before he went into the hospital? Because it said he like self-admitted himself to the hospital 4 months earlier. It wasn't like he'd done something, they put him in. So did they know each other beforehand and they set this up and then he like, I don't know, couldn't take the guilt or whatever, himself admitted himself, or did they like help him break out at some point and then they set it up? I also don't understand why they wanted to be involved, because they were annoyed at him for going to the papers with it. Was that because he was like always focused on the research, whereas they just kind of wanted to be involved in the chaos of it all, I guess? But I don't know why they would want to put themselves in that position, because it doesn't explain how it needed something at the end to explain like how they got out, like who came and let them out and things. We're just kind of see them out, and then you don't know when it happened. And
yeah, we're supposed to just accept that this all happened at another time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, when I was watching it at the end, I was like trying to decide if it was Christopher, because when he has the glasses on, I was like, is that him? And I was like, no, it is. And then obviously Catherine looks like Catherine.
Yeah.
But then my boyfriend as well was like, he I don't know, he thought that they just met each other after it happened or something, because I said something about, oh, he was clearly lying, because he said his wife died and things, but he's in love with Catherine. And he was like, oh, right, okay. And I was like, yeah, I don't take my read on it for logic, like, because I have no idea what's going on either. But there was just like some level of deceit going on. But I'm just not really, I wanted him to be like, if he's the doctor in the hospital, I wanted him to say something about like how he was studying certain things or aspects of human behavior, and that would explain why he'd like exploited Pettis's thing to get this experiment, like to make him think that it was a good idea so that he could just basically get away with seeing people getting murdered. But there was no, it could have been good, it had the potential. When I read the synopsis, I was like, this, like, it sounds like it's going to be fun, like something like Cube or Saw or something. Exactly. Like that. And it's just not got that. Yeah, there's just no, it needs something at the end to kind of push it together to make it make a bit of sense. It's fine to be confused through a story and then at the end go, ah, that's what was happening, but there's none of that. It's just, the credits literally, it literally comes up the end on the screen, and I was like, okay,
I guess.
If you say so.
Yeah, definitely the sign of a bad movie where you need to have it explained to you before, and you're just like, wait, what? No, I mean honestly, we could sit here all day and try to plot out the chronology and figure it all out. I don't think it works. It might, but without them telling us how it worked, then at the end, I'm just like, who cares? Like, doesn't none of this mattered?
Well, there's the line at the end that Catherine says, which I wrote down in full because it's so silly. She's like, you don't control him anymore. He controls you. Kill him and come home. I love you. And then it's
that was the weirdest line.
But like the whole thing of like, you don't control him anymore. It feels like they've had this really long relationship, whether it was for the 4 months he was in the hospital or stuff that's happened before. And I wanted to know what that was. I was interested enough to be like, well, explain it to me. Like, what is that? And the fact that it literally just came out like the, like, it was just like a wah, wah, like, you're not gonna get anything else. This is all, it's ended on this line. You're just gonna have to deal with it. It was very strange. It had the potential to be so fun, and it just sort of leaned the wrong way.
Yeah, I think if there were a couple more people in the steam room, that would definitely help. If you remove the whole dating aspect, because that was pointless. I mean, like, you need to get these people there for a different reason, something that connected them, because the dating service was just very superficial. You needed to have some sort of relationship, at least between some of the people that we learn about along the way, because that's always a key when you have trapped people, is some of those people know each other, and that creates this like, that creates that sense of distrust amongst the others, because wait, you two know each other and you're in this situation, obviously you're working together. But we never got that. That was until the end when we found out that two people were together. It would have been nice to have a little bit of that to build the tension in the room.
Yeah, because like even Eric Roberts' character coming to that conclusion, I literally don't know where it came from, because Catherine and Christopher were so forgettable compared to the other four, and they were just on the sidelines. They never did anything that suggested that they knew each other. They never accidentally said something or slipped up, or there was no like kind of hint of that. And I think that would have been cool. I would have liked to have kind of started discovering that along with his character, instead of it just being at the end when they show up when he's like wearing a white coat and glasses and you're like, ah, so he's a doctor. And that was it. It was just, they were so close
so to close.
Be like a good mystery, and they just ruined it.
Maybe in someone else's hands, it would have worked out.
Yeah, maybe if someone just re-edited a bit and just stuck another scene on the end, just something a bit more explanatory. I thought even like when the psychiatric hospital nurse showed up to kind of transport him back, I thought maybe she was even going to just like, something that the policeman would be like, oh my god. But there was apart from her saying like, oh, he escaped like however long ago, was it a day ago, he's only been out like a day or something, was it? There was nothing really, I don't know, I just wanted something more at the end and to tie it together, and I would have forgiven a lot of the past stuff. But
I don't know what's worse, a truly bad movie, this is a bad movie, or a bad movie that had promise. And I think that's where I really don't like this film, because it could have been something good.
Yeah. I mean, it's the synopsis sounded very interesting, even though even from the start, the whole global warming element sounded a little silly, but the whole people are trapped and things. And I think the reveal of it happened months ago and they're just going down like a sauna somewhere and finding all the skeletons or something, like that happens loads of those type of films, and even that would have been like passable. The confusion.
They introduced the idea that they were renovating this hotel.
Mm-hmm.
The last scene could have been them opening the steam room for the renovation, and there's the bodies, like you said.
Yeah.
That would have been perfect. And then we would have understood, oh, this all happened in the past, especially if they're skeletons.
Yeah. I know, just something to just tie it all together a little bit, because there was definitely the hints of this isn't happening now. He seemed to know all the story.
Yeah.
The guy with the nail gun potentially being him, the cameras that were useless if he wasn't there watching them. Like, there was just all these elements that, it just needed something at the end. But yeah, you're right, because I read synopsises for bad horror films all the time and I'm like, that sounds terrible, and then it is terrible and I'm fine. But this one I was like, oh, that sounds really good, and then when it finished I was like, what? so it slightly makes me angrier that it had the potential to be a lot of fun and it just was absolutely bamboozling.
Well, we have had our say, so let's hear from some others.
Come, children, let's explore the kills and valleys.
So kills and valleys are the best and worst reviews of this film. Now, on Rotten Tomatoes, the Chaos Experiment has no rating. There's one review, and it's no longer available online. So, I mean, this movie is one that very few people have seen. It's actually not available to stream anywhere, so it's like it definitely is going to be lost to time, I have a feeling, in the end. So we are there to keep its flame going and tell people about it. There are some reviews online, just minor ones. There is actually a piece about the film by April Wolf of LA Weekly. So she talks about all the behind the scenes struggles with the film, as well as the bizarre editing decisions. Her focus is more on the business side of things. The fact that this was a huge failure for Grand Rapids. Grand Rapids in Michigan, they actually had a film tax credit that they had. They canceled it after this movie.
Wow.
Yeah, so that says it all. Over on Amazon, the unwashed masses have left us just 41 reviews. And again, that says it all, is that if Amazon only has 41 reviews, nobody has seen this film. And again, that's because it doesn't stream. Of those reviews, 69% were 5-star. I mean, that's crazy. Here's some of the reviews. I first saw Val Kilmer in the third Batman film. This movie is all right, but not as good as Batman Forever or Tombstone, from what I've heard. So they didn't even watch Tombstone. They just...
Yeah, they're just like, rumor has it.
The transitions are kind of weird, because in the scene with Dr. Jimmy Pettis in the police car, he's in the back seat, but the transition also makes him look like he's in the passenger seat as well, which, yes, it's true. I would give this movie a 4.9 out of 5-star rating because it's too weird and has a poor plot. So too weird and a poor plot is just 0.1% of a rating.
Wow.
Plot is only that important to this person.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Val Kilmer is one of the best actors of our time, and it can be seen here in certain places when he is talking with Armando Sante. I agree. The scenes with Armando Sante are probably the best part of this film.
Yeah.
This is a good film, but not a great film, but a good film. And I am grateful that I bought it and can enjoy it on several occasions, which I do. I would say this for all those who just want to not bother, then you could be missing a film that you will enjoy.
I mean, no. True. That's true with every film. You could be missing a film you would enjoy. But
I think we can both agree. No, you would not enjoy this film. No. Most people would not. Maybe if you had a head wound like Val Kilmer's character, you would enjoy this film. just 6% of the reviews were 1-star. The steam room scenes are cross-cut with the police interrogation, helping them make the Chaos Experiment all the more disjointed. Though beautifully filmed and with plenty of mentions of Detroit, there's little else going for the film. This experiment has failed. Somebody who really likes Detroit apparently wanted that movie to work out, but it did not.
God.
the script is really strange. Nothing seems to make any sense, and whatever plot there is doesn't follow any normal story structure. And what's with all the never-ending slow motion scenes in the steam room? It seems like the director tried to be artsy and ended up just being pretentious and silly. And that is dead on.
Yeah, that's perfect.
I think the real experiment of this movie was to see how much chaos could be created by having people watch it and then realize what a mistake they just made. If that's what the purpose of this film was, then it certainly did its job.
Nice.
And yep. One final one. Once Eve Morrow put her top back on, the movie was over for me.
I mean,
some people have the things that they like about movies.
Yep, definitely. Yeah, when I went to log this on Letterboxd, I kind of hovered over the little graph that does like all the different stars review, and there was only like 20 people for each kind of thing, so maybe added up to like 120 people or something. I'd logged it on Letterboxd and I was like, that's so small.
It is
like a film that has actual actors.
Yes, that's the crazy thing, is that there's names in this movie.
Yeah. I know, you think people would just watch it because they're like, oh, I like Val Kilmer or like Eric Roberts or whatever, like you think it, more people would just come across it, but it doesn't seem like it.
It did not work.
To be fair, I had not heard of it under either title.
That doesn't help. Yeah,
I watched it for this. So yeah, it might have been a bit of that. It just kind of flew under the radar.
Forgotten movie.
Yeah.
So we have a decision to make.
With or without Val.
Do you think Val Kilmer makes or breaks this movie?
I think he's definitely one of the best actors in it. And like you said, I think most of the interesting scenes are him talking with the policeman and stuff. I just kind of wish we'd found out a little bit more about his character, but I mean, that's not his fault, it's mainly the writing. No. So I think it's better for having him in it, definitely. I think he's the most interesting character, and you are, when it went back to the scenes where he was talking to the policeman, I was always kind of like excited to kind of find out what was going on and what he was going to say and things. So I think he makes it.
Yeah, I think if he wasn't in this movie, I would have turned it off in about 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it's so bad. I mean, I don't think he could have raised anything about this movie, because it really, the focus is the steam room, and he's not in the steam room. And so that taking that out makes it really hard to really care about what's happening in this movie. And I just, it's a brutal film to watch because it makes no sense. And I'll just watch a clip online. If I could find one of him and Amanda Sande, that would be enough for anybody to watch this movie.
Yeah.
And you don't have to watch the rest of it unless like that guy in the review liked Eve Morrow when her top was off. Maybe that's your thing, but otherwise, no.
Yeah.
So we're going to play a little game now. This game is, we'll have to finish it. So this film is about people being in a sauna. And obviously, for anybody who knows the Finnish people, saunas are a huge part of Finnish life. And so what I did was I translated Val Kilmer films into Finnish. And you will try to guess what these Val Kilmer film titles are.
Oh, man.
Okay. Now, Finnish is a unique language. I don't know if you know Finnish. I should have probably asked that beforehand.
No, I don't.
Because that would have ruined the whole game if you're just like, yes, boom, 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 boom.
Yeah. I'm actually fluent. Yeah, no, I have no idea.
So I will play the I did not speak these because I do not speak Finnish, but I will play these clips of the Finnish titles of Val Kilmer films and see if you can guess what they are. So okay. Here's the first one.
Ovet.
Do you want it again?
Yeah, go for it.
Ovet.
I'm going to say heat.
Ovet is the doors.
That makes sense when you say it. It sounds like open.
Yeah.
Damn.
Here's number two.
Lääkäri mo on saari.
That sounds like a long one.
It is a long title. Would you like it again?
Yeah.
Lääkäri mo on saari.
I'm going to say the ghost in the darkness.
No, it was the Island of Dr. Moreau.
Oh, see, I thought that, and then I was like, no, surely Moreau would just be the same.
It actually, apparently it reversed because Moreau is in the middle of that one.
Oh.
It's just, it kind of gets lost in the finish.
That's so annoying, because I literally just, I just finished reading that book, so I had it in my head, and I was like, I was waiting for that one. Damn it, okay.
Here's number three.
Lämpö.
Would you like it one more time?
Yeah.
Lämpö.
I'm gonna say willow.
No, that was heat.
Again, I was like, once I guess one and it's wrong, it's gonna come up in the next one. I just didn't want to be bored and guess the same one again. Okay.
Okay, here's number four.
Todellinen nero.
Batman Forever.
That was real genius. Real genius.
It sounded like forever, though. Again, I've probably Batman and Pifinish is probably just Batman.
Yeah, I didn't include Batman, just so you know. Yeah. Because it is Batman. And oddly, what I found was that Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is mm-hmm. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in Finnish.
Oh, wow.
Just okay. Very odd.
Yeah.
Here is the next one.
Pyhimys.
You want it again?
Yeah.
Pyhimys.
I'm going to say Tombstone.
That was the saint. Your finish is not strong.
I was going to say, I don't know why I'm devastated. I literally couldn't even tell you where to finish.
Your neighbors to the east, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So here's the next one.
Hautakivi.
I will give you a hint. Syllables don't match up from Finnish to English. So even though there's three here, it's the word, the title does not have three syllables in it.
Hautakivi.
Actually, that's four, so it actually has way less than four. Well, at least half of that.
Top Gun?
Tombstone.
Ah! So, I'm like, guessing all the right films.
You're all around it. You're in
the wrong place, yeah.
You're playing Battleship. Here's your next one.
Huippusalainen.
Want to hear it again?
Yeah.
Huippusalainen.
True Romance.
Top Gun.
Honestly, I'm like one answer behind. Just edit it. Edit my answers and put them back on and I'll be fine.
Well, let's see. Maybe your pattern follows.
Tosi rakkaus.
I mean, you're making me want to say True Romance though, just to be safe.
I feel like when I play it a second time, you definitely, it helps you a lot. Like, it seems like every time I play it a second time, you're really getting it.
Tosi rakkaus.
Trust your instincts.
True Romance?
True Romance, yay!
Yay.
You're literally like one off on most of them.
Yeah, that's so weird.
And we have one left.
Okay.
Bayou.
I'll play it one more time.
Bayou.
I'm trying to think what I haven't said.
Or maybe something you have said.
Yeah. I'll say Willow again, just because.
Two in a row. Willow. Which is funny because that was your first guess, so it looped back around.
Yeah. Well, that's the one I said is my favorite. I should probably say it again. Just to
yes, absolutely. I saved it for last.
Yeah.
Well, that's all for this episode of KilmerCast. I'd love to thank you, Kim, for joining me. And I apologize for putting you through this film.
I know, it's quite all right. I have watched so many terrible horror films in my lifetime that this just skimmed the surface, so it was fine.
Do you have anything you'd like to plug?
Yeah, so I write for an online magazine called Ghouls Magazine, which is horror through like a female perspective. We do loads of reviews and essays and stuff over there, so you can go and check them out. And then I have my own blog called Little Red Horror Blog, which I mostly write sort of weird and wonderful lists about like very specific scenes and or injuries, and I also write a column comparing like remakes to their originals as well. So if that is your bag, you can follow me on my blog.
And where can people find you on social media?
So I'm on Twitter and Instagram. It's at wickedsister69 because I chose my email address when I was 15. I've really committed to it. I've just not got rid of it. On there. On most things is at wickedsister69. It's me. You can find me. But I'm very active on Twitter. So come follow me.
Great. In our next episode, we're heading back to 1998 to get biblical with the Prince of Egypt. In the meanwhile, please email any thoughts, questions, or comments to kilmercast@gmail.com and follow the show on Twitter at kilmercast2ks. For myself and my guest, Kim Morrison, thank you for listening, and remember to keep it Kilmer.
Thank you.